This is an ABC podcast. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, it's great to have you company for The Country Hour this Tuesday afternoon. I'm Cassie Huff. It seems agricultural records are falling left, right and centre at the moment. The Australian dairy industry has had one of its most profitable years in recent times, and South Australian grain prices off the header during harvest are at a new record.
Recent prices are significant because they've moved to record levels in both the Port Adelaide zone and right around into the Port Lincoln zone. So they're the highest prices we've ever had for grain delivered into the system. And more importantly, of course, it means it's also the highest prices that we've had available off the header during our harvest period.
And every cent will be needed to make up for downgrades. So I'll have more on the South Australian grain prices soon. But if you look at the whole country, the gross value of farm production will hit a record-breaking $78 billion this financial year. And the good news doesn't stop there, with ABARES predicting exports will also smash a record, estimated to hit $61 billion there as well. Clint Jasper spoke with ABARES Executive Director Jared Greenville, who says it's a unicorn season for Australian farmers.
When we look at the export price basket of goods, what we're seeing is that really Australia's commodities are priced at their highest level in 30 years, and that's taken us back to a time when the wool price reserve was in existence and inflating prices and the like. But one of the main things I think really this shows is when seasonal conditions have turned to now two positive years or two really strong years in a row, all those underlying productivity improvements that have been going on, and we've seen production continue despite some pretty poor seasonal conditions, they're all kind of coming to the fore here. And we're seeing this big production number.
And there's obviously been some challenging conditions, especially in New South Wales and parts of Queensland. We had the mice and then the heavy rains and floods, but it doesn't look like any of that has put a dent in these forecasts.
Yeah, so we have had all those things. And I guess it, you know, potentially would have been even higher if we had not had those things. On mice, it seemed to be pretty effective pest control on farms that have really diminished some of the activity that we've seen. They still remain a risk for coming into summer. And obviously that's going to hit the back pocket of producers who've had to pay those extra costs and trying to keep pests out. For flooding, there is some effects, particularly, as you say, in New South Wales. We're seeing some crop losses occurring, and we're also seeing some pretty significant downgrades in terms of crops that would have otherwise went into, you know, human consumption, now into stock feed, and we're taking, you know, a fair bit of value out of the crop because of that. But still, despite all that, having a really big crop out of WA and elsewhere in the country is keeping the national numbers up really quite high.
With the global stocks situation for grains like wheat, is even the animal feed grade price higher than it normally would be?
Yeah, it is. So what we're seeing is that, you know, prices for wheat are about, you know, 50% above what they were last year. And that also includes, you know, for stock feed. And so looking at the latest prices out of South Australia, and we're seeing that, you know, feed wheat's trading at about a $50 discount, but it's still 41% above what it was last year. So that whole price lifting is occurring across the basket, as you say, so including the stock feed.
And as we head into next year, La Nina's going to keep the soil moisture up on the East Coast and plenty of pasture around for livestock producers. So are farmers looking to be pretty well set up for another pretty good season?
Yeah, we're starting to see some of the benefits of the restocking that's going on as well. And so production levels are starting to creep up again across the livestock sector, and so particularly for sheep, but also coming into for beef production. That's keeping also domestic prices up, as you say. That good pasture availability is keeping the demand for restockers up. And so we've seen a bit of an increase in production, but also very high sale yard prices that are leading to a higher value for the sector overall. As we, I guess, go forward, we would expect to see some of the additional benefits of that restocking flow through to production, and hopefully even higher production as we go into the out years.
That total gross farm production value figure, $78 billion, it seems like the logical conclusion of a year where almost every week we've been hearing about sale yard records being smashed.
Yeah, that's certainly right. And so when you put on top of that the records, as we were just discussing, in canola and very high prices for wheat, it really is kind of coming to that point where now we don't see these events very often at all, and I don't think we've really seen that combination of really high prices and a big jump in production in the time that we've been keeping kind of records on this. So it is a pretty special event.
And the last time we were talking about a bumper or record crop, I think that was 2016. So that was a huge volume, but not at these prices.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so we've gone a bit above that, about 3% above that last big winter crop that we saw in 2016-17. But we didn't have the same kind of record level prices that we're seeing at the moment.
Now, do you see the rising prices for things like bulk shipping, fuel, fertilizer, ag chemicals, those key inputs, eating significantly into farm profits? Or are we looking at prices that are so good there's actually a decent buffer against those inflation in those items?
Yeah, they will eat into farm profits, but the prices are high enough that there is a bit of a buffer. So just to give a bit of a flavour for the share of those costs. So for cropping businesses, fertiliser costs generally account for around 16 to 18% of their total costs. And for broadacre, it's less, around 6%. So we do have an impact, but at the same time, that price effect is starting to outweigh. And we're forecasting that net farm cash income for the sector will be at its highest level that we've seen ever as well. So to combine with this highest ever gross value of production.
Just finally, when you look at the global picture, is there any easing on the horizon for the poorer conditions we've seen in places like Canada that have really affected canola production? And I know it's been dry in Russia and parts of the US and Brazil and Argentina as well.
Yeah, so it'll be linked to really some of the factors that are driving our higher production in that La Nina event, particularly for South America, which also does extend into some of the production conditions in North America. It's hard, you know, the longer term or medium term climate forecasts aren't all that accurate, and we get a bit of a picture. So I guess just from experience, we know that a run of good seasons in Australia is pretty unusual, and things will switch back. And so the expectation will be that, you know, things will change in the next couple of years as we go through. So, you know, we can't expect this kind of, you know, low production in the Northern Hemisphere and high production in Australia to continue for too much longer, I would say.
ABARES Director Jared Greenville speaking with Clint Jasper. Speaking of records, the price for grain in South Australia off the header during harvest is at a new record, according to one analyst. Recently, Viterra posted an APW wheat price of $436 a tonne at Roseworthy, something analyst Malcolm Bartholomaeus says he's never seen before. Mr. Bartholomaeus says these sort of prices are normally reserved for droughts, but international factors are contributing.
Recent prices are significant because they've moved to record levels in both the Port Adelaide zone and right around into the Port Lincoln zone. So they're the highest prices we've ever had for grain delivered into the system. And more importantly, of course, it means it's also the highest prices that we've had available off the header during our harvest period.
What have been some of these record prices and where are they?
Yeah, the previous record was $435 a tonne in the daily records that I've been keeping for a number of years now, and that went right back to a brief period of time in March 2008. And then we had another few days in October 2018 where we had prices at that level. And so in the last week here in South Australia, prices have moved to $440, $441 a tonne, you know, from varying a little bit from day to day, but the prices have been able to hold up at those high levels.
What are some of the pressures and factors that are pushing those prices so high?
Yeah, we normally only see prices at those sorts of levels when we have a drought situation here in Australia. So that was the case in 2018. And every other time that we've been, in the high 300s or low 400s, it has been associated with drought. The exception to that, of course, was back in 2008, when it was a little bit similar to the current situation in global markets, where global supplies of wheat suddenly got very tight. and it was the global market that was pushing the price up. So that's really what's happening now. It's actually coming from offshore. It's the global market that has allowed our market to push these very high levels. Our market had been resisting following those global prices up. And then when, of course, the rainfall event started to happen, which, you know, been now across Western Australia, parts of South Australia and New South Wales, probably in the last 10 days, that's what really allowed our market to push to these new record levels. But the prices we are seeing are fully supported by offshore price levels.
Do we have any indication as to how long these prices could last, or is that a little too unclear to say?
I think the international market is sort of topping out. I don't think it can really afford to go much higher. You know, the current high prices are doing their job of rationing demand, of allocating grain to the markets where it needs to go to. The Russians are talking about putting on an export quota. That's probably heating the market up at the moment as importers move to try and get grain before import restrictions come into place. So we could actually see the heat come out of the market from February, March onwards next year, when importers lose interest in continuing to buy more wheat for a little while. The Northern Hemisphere harvest will be starting to come onto the horizon, with the Indian harvest in March, April next year. And if the marketplace sees the 2023 crop developing normally, that will also take a bit of pressure off. So we might have another couple of months, 2 or 3 months, before pressure starts to come on the market. But it could come off quite sharply if next year's crop is looking okay.
Analyst Malcolm Bartholomew speaking with Lucas Forbes. It's 16 minutes past 12.
Nominations are now open for Farmer of the Year, with 10 categories spanning all ages and stages of life on the land. Let's recognise the hard work of our rural leaders, innovators and farming legends, and celebrate those in our rural sector who go above and beyond. You can enter yourself or someone you know at farmeroftheyear.com.au. Proudly supported by the Kundinan Group and ABC Rural.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Yes, as you've heard, it's been an amazing year for agriculture. So maybe it's the year you nominate yourself or someone else for the Farmer of the Year Awards. There's a few different categories. There's the Australian Farmer of the Year, Young Farmer of the Year and Farming Legend of the Year, as well as Rural Community Leader of the Year, the Rural Consultant, the Agricultural Student, and the Awards for Excellence and Innovation, Technology Diversification and Agricultural Research. So there's a few bites of the cherry there, lots of opportunities. It'd be great to have some more South Australian winners. I think we've had a bit of a lack of South Australian nominees in recent years, so it'd be great to have some South Australian agriculture recognised in the awards. So do go to farmeroftheyear.com.au to nominate. Before I get to weather, the Australian dairy industry has also had one of its most profitable years in recent times, but it hasn't helped production, with the milk pool expected to stagnate. That's according to Dairy Australia's latest Situation and Outlook report released yesterday. Peter Somerville talked through the update with the DA's senior industry analyst, Sophia Olmsted, who says the wet conditions have slowed growth.
There's a number of factors that are quite favourable for ongoing farm gate profitability this season. We've, for example, seen that global dairy market dynamics have really improved. Commodity prices are increasing. However, there's been quite a lot of challenges related to the really wet weather this year. And that has definitely impacted on many and created some challenging conditions to work through.
And so in amongst all of that, this update shows that the 2020-21 season proved to be one of the most profitable for the dairy industry.
That's it. So according to data from the Dairy Farm Monitor Project, this last season we've had has been one of the most profitable in recent times across most dairy regions of Australia. And in fact, one of the most profitable ones in over a decade in New South Wales and Queensland. Many farmers reported record returns, which is really fantastic. And we also know that thanks to this season, the health of many farm businesses has really improved.
What's happening globally to feed into this picture?
Yeah, so globally, the real change in the last few months is that a lot less milk is being produced on the global market. So we have seen a slowdown in milk production in the US and the EU. We have seen less milk being produced here in Australia and in New Zealand. And at the same time, more countries have re-emerged from lockdown. So demand has really started to pick up, which has seen that commodity prices for most dairy commodities have really increased.
What's that likely to mean here when Australia's milk pool is also unlikely to grow?
Yeah, well, what we continue to see is very strong competition for milk at the farm gate, as evident by the latest milk price step-ups that we have seen in the last few weeks. And obviously, with the fact that Australia's milk pool looks quite unlikely to grow this year, we would expect that competition for milk to remain quite fierce heading into next year.
Farmers shouldn't really be sweating next year's milk price then.
Well, I was going to say it's always a long way to go. But for now, if you look from a market point of view, it doesn't look like we'll have a lot more supply on the global market until maybe next Northern Hemisphere spring. And at the same time, demand is quite firm. So for now, many things are looking quite good for the year ahead.
Some would say it's been incredibly wet and perhaps to the point where that's no longer looking good. How's that affected the picture, all of this rain?
It's definitely had an impact. So wet weather, a wet winter and a wet spring has really created a lot of challenges, especially in southeastern Australia and in WA. It's delayed the harvest, it's caused flooding, and we've seen that it's impacted on per cow yields. So that is one of the reasons why we don't believe we'll see any particular growth in Australia's milk pool this year. Obviously, the wet weather has had an impact on slowing down milk production during the first 4 months of this season. But we do also know that there's other factors that are weighing on the possibility of growth this year, and that includes labor shortages, as well as really firm beef and land prices, which has enticed which has encouraged some to continue to cull and some farm exits. And that's obviously also playing an impact on slowing milk production.
And just on another front, it wasn't really that long ago that we were talking about panic buying in the pandemic. Has that all stabilised? What's consumption doing at the moment?
Yes, panic buying seems to be a bit of a thing of the past now at last. So while obviously the pandemic continues, we've really seen consumers revert back to more long-term trends. So we've seen spending through food service venues really recover, and they're up compared to a year ago. And retail sales have slowed down compared to last year when it was all that panic buying, but it remains elevated compared to 2019 year levels.
Dairy Australia's senior industry analyst Sophia Olmsted speaking there with Peter Somerville. We'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology now because there's a bit of wind around. Simon Timke is the senior forecaster on duty. Good afternoon.
G'day, Cassie.
So I see there's some wind warnings for today and tomorrow. What's going on?
Yeah, that's right. Over the coastal waters, we've got a warning out for northern Spencer Gulf today. And then for tomorrow, Spencer Gulf, Gulf St Vincent, upper southeast and also the upper west coast. So we've had a little weak cold front move across this morning, and we're just seeing those winds, those southerly winds surge a little bit in behind that change, and I think we'll see a little bit more freshening with the sea breeze during the afternoon. So they won't be strong for a long period, but I think late afternoon each day and early evening, we'll see those winds reaching 20 to 30 knots or so on those parts of our coastal waters. So a little bit strong at times, as well as a freshening of the winds. That cold front did bring a little bit of light shower activity this morning. Up to 9 a.m. this morning, we did see a few spots pick up a small amount of rainfall in the south. The wettest place was actually Ernabella Pukacha, right up in the far northwest, where there were some storms late yesterday and early this morning. 8 millimetres recorded up there. Next, Balaclava had 2 millimetres, and a couple of spots down near Mount Bold Reservoir and the Mount Lofty Ranges there had a couple of millimetres, and Nangwari in the southeast picked up 1.4 millimetres too. But I think those showers pretty much now contracted back to southern coasts and ranges, and near western coast there's still a couple there as well, but not expecting too much in the way of totals out of those light showers around for the rest of today. And right up in the far northwest of the state, chance that there could be another couple of showers, possibly a thunderstorm around later on in the day today. So conditions generally cool to mild near the coast. The southerly winds are keeping those temperatures down. Warm inland and hot right up over the far northern parts of the pastoral districts. On the way for Wednesday, pretty similar sort of conditions. We don't see a lot of change in the next 24 hours as that front weakens and moves away. There's a high pressure system centred well south of Western Australia that's a pretty slow moving feature, so it'll be centred well south of the Bight tomorrow, south of Tasmania by Saturday. So that's sort of the dominant feature on our weather for the rest of the week as it extends a ridge up over South Australia. So not much change in the weather over the next couple of days. So for Wednesday, just a slight chance of a light shower near southern coasts and ranges, and dry over remaining parts of the state. And conditions still pretty cool to mild near the coast in those southerly winds on the eastern flank of that high. Warm over inland and hot in the northeast again. And I did mention that strong wind warning for tomorrow for the coastal waters. For Thursday, I think just near southern coasts, the chance of a light shower, and the rest of the state will be dry. So a couple of mostly dry days for South Australia, Wednesday, Thursday, and then Friday, another dry day. We'll see the winds start to tend around a little bit more easterly, so temperatures starting to rise a little bit then. And then for the weekend, quite a hot weekend ahead of us. The high, when it gets down to south of Tassie there, will turn the winds around more northeasterly, so we'll start to drag some hotter air from the north down over our state. And for Saturday, again, mostly dry right across the state, just a slight chance of a shower, maybe a rumble of thunder near the western border on Saturday, and that extending over the far west on Sunday, and then a slight chance of showers extending over the west and south of the state on Monday, and maybe a rumble of thunder over the south as well on Monday. So really mostly dry conditions for the rest of the week and into the weekend, with very hot conditions developing over the weekend. So rainfall totals for that 4-day period out to the end of Saturday, less than 2 millimetres anywhere that does pick up a light shower or two. So dry conditions and getting hot is the order for the rest of the week, I think, Cassie.
It does sound like it, although I was a bit taken by surprise, I must admit, by how cool it was this morning.
Yeah, well, that front, it did, you know, brought up some cool air from the south, brought some cloud in as well, and with a little bit of showery activity, those three things combined did sort of help keep those temperatures down a bit. And even though we're sort of into the start of summer now, all that water to the south of our state is still pretty cold. If anyone's sort of been in for an early season dip, they'll understand that water is pretty cold. So if we get the wind coming up from the south, it certainly keeps the temperatures down, even in early December.
But like you say, we'll know it's summer on the weekend.
We sure will.
Thanks. So that was Simon Timke from the Bureau of Meteorology speaking there. In the far west of New South Wales, the Upper Western is going to be mostly sunny. There is a medium chance of showers, though, in the far east. That's most likely in the afternoon and early evening. There isn't much chance of rain anywhere else, although there could be a thunderstorm around. The winds are going to get to about 25 to 35 kilometres an hour. Overnight temperatures will fall to between 16 and 20 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach 27 to 35 degrees. So getting quite warm there tomorrow. The lower westerns, very similar conditions. It'll be mostly sunny there as well. There's a medium chance of showers in the far east, and again, a chance of a thunderstorm in the far east as well. The winds are also going to pick up 20 to 30 kilometres an hour, getting to 25 to 35 k's an hour in the morning. Overnight temperatures will fall to between 11 and 16 degrees, but the daytime temperatures temperatures will reach the low to high 20s there as well. We've still got a lot more to come on the Country Hour this afternoon. We're going to be looking at powder made from fruit and vegetables. It's waste products that would otherwise end up in the bin that could actually be used to smuggle into the diets of kids who just don't like eating the healthy stuff. So I'll have more to come on that on the Country Hour. It is coming up to 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hello, it's great to have you company this afternoon. Soon you're going to meet a group of stranded sailors from Kiribati who have had to have a bit of a career change. They've taken up the chance to become fruit pickers in the Riverland and have had to learn very quickly how to get the job done.
They give us some technique like this. You take the orange like this and just only like this. But we try our best because we like to work for the family.
I'll have a look at some of Australia's other neighbours as well in the next half hour, particularly Indonesia and how COVID has affected food security there. But we'll pop across to the news desk now where Isabel Damon has the latest. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie. In the news this hour, South Australia's emergency coordinator is hopeful the state is still on track to continue winding back restrictions. Commissioner Grant Stevens expects SA to reach its 90% double vaccination rate between December 22nd and January the 3rd. He says further easing of restrictions also depends on the rate of Omicron infections interstate. And the Regent's Park Omicron cluster in Sydney's west has grown by 6 cases. The cluster linked to 2 schools and an indoor climate centre now stands at 20. So far, none of the 31 people infected with Omicron have been admitted to hospital. And a Port Augusta man has been reported for unlawfully acting as a justice of the peace. Police say they received information last month that the 74-year-old man had been acting as a JP in the Port Augusta township, but that his status had been terminated in December 2015. He'll be summoned to appear in court at a later date. And I'll have more news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Isabel Damon there. Now, a group of sailors from Kiribati have had a COVID-induced career change, becoming fruit pickers in the Riverland. After being stranded at a hotel in Brisbane for 6 months, the Pacific Island Council of South Australia has supported 14 of the men to find work. Eliza Burlash has found out where they ended up.
Takoya CMC is working 7 days a week picking blueberries in the Riverland. He says one of his first priorities has been to buy protective clothing.
What I need is for work, is my clothing for the work. It's very hot weather, but we need a very safe working clothes. It's a very hard job, but we enjoy this one better than nothing.
Mr. CMC and about 40 of his workmates were left stranded in Brisbane after the Danish shipping company they worked for, Maersk, ceased operations in Kiribati. Kiribati's strict border closure rules meant the men were unable to return home, effectively leaving them jobless and homeless.
This is a very big problem because after this coronavirus situation, it spent a lot. Even for us, we stay here when the company pay too much loss, and the government didn't support this kind of situation.
The men who have been receiving part wages from Maersk paid for their own flights from Brisbane to Adelaide after the Pacific Island Council of South Australia found them work picking fruit in the Riverland. While Kiribati still has its national borders closed, the men hope to extend their visas, which are due to expire in January. President of Pacific Island Council of South Australia, Takini Tavui, says it's possible the men, currently contracted directly to the farms, could be registered into the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme next year. The program streamlines the Seasonal Worker Program and Pacific Labour Scheme and will double the number of workers in industries such as agriculture, hospitality and aged care.
We've had some superficial discussions with DFAT to be able to ascertain the best way. This arrangement or this approach has never been done before, but it certainly is something that we we're exploring. And with the changes that are coming by April next year, April 4th, when the two programs will merge or will come under one department, which is DFAT, that should create other opportunities. So we are optimistic that that can proceed.
In the meantime, Mr. Tavui says a Kiribati elder is helping to settle the men into their accommodation in the Riverland by helping them with domestic support.
The president of the Kiribati Association, she's a retired lady, and so she's going to be spending about a week or two in that facility just to help them settle in. So cooking for them, just showing them, you know, about shopping and budgeting and things like that, just to ease their transition into this new role.
Nabaruru Keitabasi, who has been picking oranges, says his housemates from Vanuatu have been sharing tips on how to work faster.
They make maybe three times double our pay. They give us some technique like this. You take the orange like this and just only like this. Don't hold the fruit, because when you hold the fruit, it takes a long time, because hold. But the boys, only 1 second, poop, poop, inside the back. But we tried to follow the technique, yeah? But very hard the first time. But we try our best, because we like to work for the family.
Mr. Keitabasi says the picking work is important to support his large family at home.
Five girls and only one boy. They miss me also, especially the wife. Yeah, she's very, come back. I'm stay for the children. But now maybe they happy because they get some more money.
Nabaruru Keitabasi ending that report from Eliza Berlage. So good they were able to pick up some work. I can't imagine what it would have been like to have been stranded in a hotel in Brisbane for 6 months. Now, Kiribati is about 6,000 kilometres northeast of Australia. Indonesia is about 3,400 kilometres northwest, so the other side. And in recent years, Australian producers have been trying to break into the Indonesian market, but they're becoming increasingly frustrated. That's because Indonesia's been very focused on self-sufficiency and has been limiting how much food it imports. But a new paper from the Commonwealth's commodity forecaster ABES says COVID-19 has pushed more Indonesians into poverty, and a relaxation of the country's trade rules could reverse that trend. ABES Executive Director Jared Greenville has been speaking with Eliza Borello.
Indonesia's had, I guess, a bit of a troubled time with the pandemic, with an increase in the number of food insecure people in and people shifting into poverty. And we've seen that also globally in other areas as well, as the pandemic's really depressed economic activity. There's definitely scope for, I guess, win-wins to be had in terms of opening up the economy, and particularly opening up the agriculture sector to countries like Australia, not only to make food more affordable, but also just to help with their own recovery. Australia and Indonesia have good opportunities for mutually beneficial trade. I mean, and trade is generally always mutually beneficial, but in particular, we produce a lot of things that they don't. And we also produce a lot of things that go into their own processing, their manufacturing, food manufacturing sectors. So having better trade with Australia and countries like Australia can also spur some of that job creation and economic activity in other sectors as well, which can help with that poverty issue.
This report says that despite the losses Indonesia has experienced because of COVID-19, income should keep growing once the health crisis is over, which in turn will see the country's young, increasingly urbanised middle class put pressure on policymakers to allow more imports into the country. Which Australian agri-foods might they be demanding?
So there's particular, I guess, scope for some of our fruits and vegetables, like particularly the fruits in cold climate kind of products. Red meat is another one where there's a large opportunity, just because of the land mass that Australia has and the relative comparative advantage that we have in producing beef and sheep meat and the like. So there's a couple of things that really could really plug into that growing demand, where we're expecting, you know, a big growth based on those longer term trends, as you see in income and as Indonesia's population grows again and also becomes wealthier, will shift the demand away from some of the more traditional foods to a more diverse, and sometimes, as we see across other countries, to a more kind of Western style diet.
beef producers, for example, have had a long history of dealing with Indonesia. What would you say to producers who perhaps have been frustrated at attempts to get into the Indonesian market? What can they do between now and when this demand is expected to come on to make sure that their products are part of the demand mix?
It's a bit of a long game, as you say. So Australia does have a long relationship with Indonesia, being one of our closest neighbours. And so I think the key thing, as we know, that there's been frustrations in the trade, and it's a fairly complex regulatory environment when trading within Indonesia to engage with. So one of the things is really, I think, persistence and making sure that Australia remains a reliable supplier of products into Indonesia. There's a number of steps also that have been taken with free trade agreements that can open up markets, and that might be incremental rather than, you know, a sudden rush. But I think the incremental and the long-term story really points to the value at persisting at closer market ties and business ties with Indonesia, as we'd expect. You know, if some of these numbers do come to bear in the future, then there's going to be a big opportunity there.
ABARES Executive Director Jarrod Greenville speaking with Eliza Borello. And speaking of meat to Indonesia in particular, live cattle exports to Indonesia are well down this year. And data suggests that Indonesia has actually been filling that gap by importing more frozen boxed meat. Analyst Simon Quilty says India and Brazil are targeting markets in Southeast Asia, and it could have serious ramifications for Australia's live cattle trade. Mr. Quilty is speaking here to Matt Brann.
Even though we've had a fall in terms of the numbers of live cattle into Indonesia this year, Matt, in actual fact, if you looked at the consumption of meat itself, overall, Indonesia's up. So we had 54,800 less cattle going in from January through to September, but 30,000 tons of extra beef and buffalo for that same period, Matt. So in reality, you know, Indonesia is up by 18 to 20,000 tons for the year so far in terms of meat consumption. I think the interesting part is when it comes to live cattle, we've simply just outpriced ourselves in that market.
And so who has exactly filled the void there?
It's mainly been filled, of course, by Indian buffalo. And you know, last year, in the same period, the first 9 months, they made up 44% of the meat imports, and this year it's jumped up to 53%. So they've shipped so far for the year just over 74,000 metric tons. And Australia sits really in the second terms of major suppliers of boxed beef. We're at 37,000 tons this year, almost identical to last year. But the most interesting one of all has been Brazil, who in the last few months have really aggressively stepped into this market. And, you know, the early October figures are already showing about a 3,500-ton month for October alone. So,
And Brazil stepping in a big way, does that come back to its relationship with China not going so well?
Yes, it does. So it's that lack of access, ongoing access into China, that's the deep, deep concern, because China is their number one market. And we know, you know, we saw that extraordinary amount exported in September this year of 110,000 metric tons in 1 month alone. So now the ban continues, Matt. They're looking to secondary markets to put their meat into because they still do not have access to China. And Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, Vietnam are all part of that secondary market. And as I just said, October's already showing signs that they're aggressively selling into these alternate markets.
So if Indonesia is importing more Indian buffalo meat, Brazil now looking to push more beef into these type of markets, what does all of this mean for Australia's live cattle trade?
I think it is some very strong headwinds for 2022. And interestingly, Indian buffalo continues to fall in value. So we've had four consecutive months where Indian buffalo has fallen around about 5 to 7% in value, while we know in out of Australia and America, our prices have been moving higher. So once again, India is suffering the same as what Brazil is, and that is that the access into China via the grey trade, Hong Kong and Vietnam, has stopped. So they too cannot place the large volumes of Indian buffalo into China that they once did. And as a result, their pricing has fallen for 4 months in a row while the rest of the world was going up. So I see that trend continuing next year, Matt, because it looks like that grey trade has come to a standstill. And as a result, cheaper Indian buffalo, cheaper Brazilian meat if they don't get access, it makes it really hard for Australian live cattle exporters to compete in that environment.
Australian cattle producers have heard stories before about Indian buffalo meat and how it could take over the market, but that's never really transpired.
No, it hasn't. No, I agree.
Do you feel things have really changed?
No, I think it's found a place and a role, and it seems to be very much in the manufacturing end of the Indonesian market. I still think, you know, when it comes to the wet markets and the role in the food service sector, and to a certain extent the retail sector, but it's been very difficult for Indian buffalo to have any, I think, major presence in those areas. So to me, you know, they belong in very different categories. Part of this year has no doubt been challenging with COVID and the closures and the shutdowns that they've had across Indonesia. But it probably just points to a greater retail demand, and that's where the manufacturing side of things has increased just through retail. But Matt, yeah, I think that the role of Indian buffalo is somewhat finite within Indonesia itself. It'll be interesting, though, to see where Brazil's role evolves over the next year if they are continuing to sell cheaply into that market as well.
Because Australian cattle prices are expected to at least ease next year. So could this moment for Indian buffalo meat and Brazilian beef be a bit short-lived?
Probably could be. I mean, you know, it's so challenging with Australia and trying to bet, you know, understand and forecast cattle prices. I've got next year for the first half of the year, the feeder steer market remaining in pretty good shape, Matt. It's the back end of next year, in particular the final quarter, that will, I think, the correction that we've been waiting for will start to really unfold. So to answer your question, I think the first half of next year in terms of live cattle exports is going to be challenging. I think we're still going to get these cheap Brazilian and Indian buffalo in that market, and Australian live cattle prices will be struggling to come to a more competitive level. They'll be still very, very high. But in the back end of next year, things might start to correct themselves.
Simon Quilty from Global AgriTrends speaking to Matt Brann. And a text in says, Brazil are destroying their forests big time to open up for grazing and cropping. Thanks for that text. You can keep texting me on anything that interests you in the program, 0467 922 891, or phone 1300 222 891. It's 13 minutes to 1.
Ah, summer. The perfect time to dive into ABC iView. You can stock your entertainment esky with what you want to watch by logging into ABC iView using your ABC account.
I bet it's amazing.
Keep a watch list, check out some recommendations, and pick up watching exactly where you left off across all your logged in devices. It's your ABC iView, so log in with your ABC account and make it your own.
It's all yours!
All your summer streaming on ABC iView.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Powder made from fruit and vegetables that might otherwise go to waste could soon be smuggled into the diets of kids who just won't eat their greens. The CSIRO has been working on this technology for the last few years, and now Victorian vegetable grower Raquel Said says her family has set up a food manufacturing company called Nutrive, which commercialised the process of making a highly nutritious powder from broccoli.
So essentially what we do is we take 100% Australian grown and made vegetables, mostly vegetables that, you know, potentially don't have a home. They're, you know, too big, too small, not quite right for retail spec. And we're trying to turn them into an upcycled vegetable ingredient. So predominantly vegetable powders, but also for products that can be included in other food products or beverage products or supplements, etc. What we're doing is really reimagining how we can actually consume vegetables and repurpose that food waste on farm.
CSIRO has developed the method, and I imagine there's some pretty good tech that goes into it. But is it dehydrated? Mm-hmm. Is it freeze dried? How do you turn broccoli into broccoli powder?
You'd think that it would just be very straightforward. In fact, there's a bit of there's intense science that kind of goes into the background. But I will say that, you know, that sort of first project of taking the vegetables and turning them into powder, that's probably not where the sort of exciting or the IP sits. It's almost a process of, I mean, I guess you could call it a form of dehydration in terms of we are removing that water and keeping all of the other, you know, great nutrients in the product, which is what makes broccoli so special. For example, it's super high in protein on a dry basis. There's 30% super high in dietary fiber. But what's probably more special about the way CSIRO have worked with us is that we've worked with them on actually creating enhanced nutritional content using their technology as well as that broccoli. So I wouldn't say that the CSIRO technology is in the drying of the broccoli powder as such, but we've got further projects that we're working with them on, for example, projects in the microencapsulation space of healthy oils and also fermenting the broccoli as well and understanding what great bioactives can be available from that. So the project is a bit bigger than just vegetable powders, which is great news for innovation in the food space.
Well, tell me about how people might eat these broccoli products in the future.
We've been doing so many fun experiments, even just in our own kitchens, just to sort of validate what works, what doesn't work. The simplest form is to put them in your morning smoothie. You can mix them into soups. You can put a sprinkle into anything that you are baking. So I know that us in our team will often put it into wraps. We'll stir it into dips, yogurts as well. So it really is as creative as you want to be with how you use your food. You can probably put it in almost anything.
You're working with your parent company, Fresh Select, but is this something that you're looking to expand to work with other growers or perhaps in other parts of the country?
Yeah, absolutely, Lucinda. So one thing that we've been sure upon this whole sort of journey is making sure that whatever model that we create has to be something that's scalable and it has to be expandable. You know, we're in the salad bowl hub of Australia right now in Werribee South, but the amount of, this problem isn't just on our farm, it's all over. So everything that we're doing, we're creating with that expansion frame of mind. And naturally also the capacity of the equipment that we're working with is quite large. So we want to be able to, at the right stage of the program, once we've, you know, done all our validation, actually, you know, invite local farmers to be able to, at the first stage, I'd say, before we'd go interstate. But I think that, that validation isn't that far off. We're probably, you know, quite close to engaging in that side of things quite soon. It's actually easier to transport powder than it is to transport raw produce. So for us, having a hub-style model where there's a drying facility in, you know, large growing hubs across Australia, I think is going to be a huge benefit. And considering there are so many food applications for that then dry products to go into, it just seems obvious that we would go to the food rather than the food coming to us to process.
Raquel Said, Operations and Sales Manager for Nutrivi, which is based in Victoria's Werribee South region. And she was speaking with Lucinda Joyce about their powdered vegetables. Finally today, did you know that South Australia is the onion state? South Australia produces most of this country's onions, but unusual November conditions are having an impact on the onion plantings this year. There's been more rain, cooler temperatures, and it's been windier than normal, particularly this month, and the wind in particular is causing some issues. But overall, Southeast grower Tony Rowett told Megan Hughes the biggest problems they're facing is, like what many farmers are facing, rising fertiliser, fuel and shipping costs.
The season we've just gone through, I think, has been affected mainly by the COVID. We've had a big production year. Shipping's been difficult. There's less demand, you know, overseas and that sort of thing because of the COVID overseas. So it's been a challenging year, actually, for us. But having said that, we managed to get right through. The product all got to market. You know, there was no dumping of product and that sort of thing, which is probably pretty good.
And what about this upcoming season? How has planting gone so far?
I think the plantings this year will be on average. The plantings will be on average, but the thing that we're facing mostly is the increase in fuel costs. So irrigation and all that sort of costs will increase quite dramatically. Fertiliser, as I think everyone is aware of that, is double in price. Some fertiliser, so input costs into that are going to be a lot higher. And the other thing that we're facing is shipping. So if we need to export, then our shipping looks like it's going to be double to export. So that's probably the most challenging things facing this season, I would say.
For you then, is it a case of going to the major supermarkets, renegotiating contracts? Are you in a position that you're able to do that, to get more money to cover those costs?
Well, it's certainly a conversation that we're going to have with the supermarkets, and we can, you know, take our paperwork there and justify our increase in costs. And at some point, that's got to filter right through to the consumer. Unless the supermarkets want to, absorb that, but I can't see the supermarkets wanting to absorb those increasing costs. So it's a conversation that we've got to have with them.
Now, the industry itself is moving towards more automation. I know that you've installed machinery in your packing shed as well. Is that another area that costs can be absorbed into if there's less labour?
Well, it's one of the factors. It is a factor. I think the reason for automation, most people are going for automation, is reliability on machinery rather than relying on people to get the job done.
What else are you expecting for this upcoming season?
We're all hoping for a good season, you know, price-wise and quality-wise and all those sorts of things. I think it's going to be probably a challenge, given the fact that our costs are going to be a lot higher. But we're a pretty resilient industry, and we seem to be able to handle most adverse things. So hopefully we get a good outcome.
Now, in terms of conditions themselves, like, we're obviously around the Bordertown area at the moment, and it has been a bit colder of a November than normal, and there's still been a bit of rain about into summer. Has that affected planting at all?
Not really. We're going all right. You know, growth's probably a little bit behind, but these last week or so, we're starting to see a bit of sunshine, so things are, you know, starting to move on okay. We have had quite a bit of wind, which is probably one of the biggest challenges in probably the whole of South Australia is movement of the soil, wind drift. So that's been a challenge. But we're in now into November, so once we get past the end of October, that wind starts to dissipate and the equinoctial gales, as they call them, slow down. So the risk is a lot lower in terms of crop damage.
That was Southeast onion grower Tony Rowett there speaking with Megan Hughes. And I think it comes as a surprise to a lot of people to learn that South Australia is the largest producing onion state in the country. But there is a lot of onions produced in this state. That's about all we have time for in the program. But it's well worth a visit to the ABC Rural page, the online page. There's a lot of information there, particularly on prices. Prices seem to be the topic at the moment with the record farm prices. There's ABARES predicting that exports will also smash a record. They're estimated to hit $61 billion this year, and just the value of farm production broke through the record at $78 billion this financial year. So there's a lot of records dropping at the moment. COVID has certainly turned a lot of supply chains on their heads, and with the good seasonal conditions here and not so much overseas, a lot of it is playing into what has been quite a good year for a lot of commodities. Obviously, hailstorms and rain has been a big dampener for some growers, but by and large, when you average it all out, it seems like there has been a lot of upside for farmers this year. So go online to abc.net.au/rural to find out more about what is happening in the sector. Now, before I go, Sonia will just give you an idea of what's coming up. Hi, Sonia.
I will indeed. In fact, will $3,000, a rebate to do to buy an electric vehicle car, will that change your mind on that front? Is it enough to change your buying habits? We'll look at that after one.
Well, I am in the market for a car, so I might listen into that. Sonia Feldhoff with more on your ABC local radio. It's coming up to 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.